Hello, and welcome to another episode of SBCC Vaquero Voices, a podcast highlighting the unique voices that comprise our campus culture and how we're all working together to serve our students and the community at large. As usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Akil Hill.
Hello.
And today we are honored to welcome Christopher Phillips to the show. Welcome.
Welcome, Chris.
Well, honored might be a little bit strong language, but I'm very happy to be here, guys. Thank you.
A true honor.
And it is an honor, absolutely, through and through.
And Chris, you are the director of the Career Center here at SBCC?
That's right. And yeah, I'm the director of the Career Center. I'm a professor and a counselor. So my role is a faculty position on this campus. And part of it is to see and have vision for the Career Center and what we're doing. I also teach career planning classes, and I also meet with students one-on-one doing career counseling.
He is a one-man band. Did you hear that?
So, yeah, a unique
perspective. I need to be, because we don't have any staff in the Career Center.
And it's good that you have the faculty and the staff perspective in tune in terms of, when running the department at the Career Center and when you're teaching your classes, you can kind of, because a lot of times we do have that, not divide, I would say, but it's kind of a peeking over the wall, so to speak, at what faculty you're doing and vice versa for staff. So it's nice to kind of dip your toes on both sides and have an awareness of things that are going on both sides.
Yeah. I mean, that's the college, that's higher education, is that wall between faculty and everybody else. And I think we're no different in some ways. And I think, yeah, whenever you can kind of bridge the two, and I think now more than ever, we need to do that. Like, and so I do find that I'm in a nice place to be able to kind of have that balance.
So the Career Center, is it the kind of thing where if I'm a student, am I going in there looking for a job, or am I going in there to kind of guide my search or kind of figure out what I want to do? I mean, where does the Career Center fit in that kind of that process of starting a career as a young person in school today?
Yes.
Good answer.
I think that's what the unique thing about the Career Center. I think all of the centers on campus have a diverse range of things that they're doing, but the Career Center, as far as a counsel, so we're a counseling office, we're here for students and we have counselors, but the range of things that one of our career counselors can do is pretty incredible. It's anywhere from just like, I'm not sure what major I should be doing. I don't even know how to approach that. I'm interested in this major, what careers are related to it. How do you, like you said, how do you find a job right now? Because I need a job to be able to stay into school. How do you go through the process of writing resumes, preparing for interviews, job searching online? And then just plain kind of work-based learning kinds of things, trying to get students connected with actual employers in our area by panel discussions, by networking opportunities. And we really, there's so many different schools within our one school, you know what I mean? And trying to like figure out, okay, what are the different areas of the school that need a particular service, kind of bespoke to like what their needs are. And then we're trying to reach out to, nursing or automotive students, and their needs are different than a freshman coming in looking to figure out what major they are. So the sheer diversity and challenge of like what needs could be coming to one of our counselors is pretty exciting, and I think you have to, there's a lot more skills. Not only do you have to have good counseling skills, but you also have to know the labor market, for example.
Yeah. I mean, in your estimation, are folks coming in, they kind of have an idea of what they want to do and they've had a few jobs before, or are these people kind of pretty new to kind of the workforce in general and just kind of looking for like basic starting kind of tips, or is it just runs the gamut no matter what?
Well, the first thing I'll say that I think is very important when you're thinking about a community college career center is that it's not happening in a vacuum. It happens that when the students are going to school, when they're trying to be successful in their classes in this semester, they're trying to go from this semester to next semester, they're trying to reach their goal of getting a certificate or transferring. And career counseling in that context is also an effort to support them in that. It's like we can't just say, oh, what job are you interested in? Like, we have to understand, well, what are your approaches to your education? What are your values around that? What are your maybe limiting thoughts about like what you can or can't do in your education? You know, what kinds of messages have you had about careers? Oh, like you should be a nurse because there's so many jobs. And then you're just like, okay, cool, I'm going to be a nurse. And unfortunately, you pass out at the sight of blood, you know, so this is not going to be a good career for you. And so like so many students, even when they think they know something, it's under very limited information. And so one of the things we're trying to do is like, you know, get information out there. And then we're trying to think about, like, for example, like first generation college students oftentimes don't know anything about the culture of education. And you, we think it's so easy because we live with the acronyms and the systems and the 10-step process. And we, you know, we think it's all like that, but they don't even know what's going on there, you know? And so we need to talk about, hey, you know, how is that going for you? And then, are you limiting yourself of what you think you can do in your education and career? Talk about social mobility, talk about how much money you're going to be making. Like, so all those things come into the conversation too.
I like that a lot. It's like a holistic approach in terms of assisting the student and figuring out what is the best fit. I mean, that's right on with that. I'm feeling that right now.
So for example, I like to talk to people, we all have these, we have like negative thoughts about our career or our ability to be successful and something maybe very challenging or otherwise. For students, they might say something like, you know, like how am I going to possibly pick a major when there's so many of them, you know, or like, I have no idea, you know, what you would do with any of these majors. So how could I even pick one now? And you're asking me to pick it. And then like taking a step back and trying to reframe that as like, oh, well, right now you don't know about the majors, but there's some specific things you could do to learn more about them or learn more about yourself and use tools to see how those things are connected to a wide range of majors. So like trying to like understand how our kind of negative thoughts about how well we're going to do or not do in education can actually change our decisions and move us away from things that we might want to do. And it really kind of like, it just sneaks up on you, you know? And so those are a lot of the, like, I'm real curious about, hey, what are you hoping to get out of your education? You know, what are you doing here? And how do those things connect maybe down the line to a range of careers and not trying to like nail somebody down to like, are you going to be a dentist? You know, are you going to be a, you know, a doctor? Are you going to be a construction worker? What, you know, like, there's more to the conversation than just picking a single thing and then feeling like you're.
And I know, and I feel like that's what was missing from my kind of what the people taught me when I was growing up, because in LA at my high school, we did career stuff freshman year. So freshman year of high school, you're 14-year-old. You want to learn about what you want to do when you grow up. I mean, basically at that age, you're just like, I can do anything. I just want to make the most money. So you look up all these jobs where you make the most money. You're looking up optometrist, dentist, yada, yada. That's where I was going. I'll be a programmer. I'll be a medical person. And then we never touched it again until I got to college. So the freshman year requirement was do the career stuff and that's it. And by the time I got out of high school and into college, my mindset was totally different. And then even 2 years, 3 years into college, my mindset shifted again. So it's one of those things where all the things I looked up and I was like kind of not set on, I wasn't like really hammered into stone, but the things that in the back of my mind I thought I wanted to do, by the time I was of age to start building to that, I didn't want to do any of that stuff anymore. So the stuff that I was looking into was totally new and kind of having to start over. And I just kind of stumbled into the path I ended up in to get here today. But if not for a couple lucky breaks, I mean, where would I be? So it's one of those things where just being aware of that fact that, you know, I mean, everyone's aware of the fact that we're, as individuals, we change a lot over the years, of course, but in terms of your career and in terms of the things that make, I was going to say make you happy, but there's no guarantee your career even makes you happy, but your career allows you to do the things that make you happy. You know, like you may not have like the old saying, you do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. It's like, no, you can do something you hate so that you can do the things that you love every day. You know, there's all kinds of different ways to look at it. So it depends on your, it's a personal approach in terms of your mindset, things like that. And that's why your holistic approach in terms of letting people figure out what they want to do and what they do best is, it sounds like right on the money, like Akil was saying. Absolutely.
And then the key to that is to teach about skills and competencies that you need as an adult to navigate your career development. Okay. And the skill isn't to like to take a test and say, okay, I'm going to be a web developer now. You know, The competencies are more about self-assessment, for example. Do you have the skills to really kind of get in tune with like what your interests are, you know, where your skills lie, you know, like that you're having a reasonable self-assessment about kind of values and skills and preferences that you have, you know, that's a skill. And a lot of the students I work with, they don't have that skill quite yet, as far as they know who they are, but it's difficult to articulate what that is. Oftentimes there's the vocabulary is missing, or you just don't know what you don't know, you know? So, you know, you're trying to like engage. And then, for example, decision-making is another skill set. And, you know, I always ask students in my class, like, how many of you have had actual class content on skills to develop decision-making? There's different decision-making. It's a science. Like, you can get a PhD in decision-making, and they're coming up with breakthroughs in cognitive processes and decision-making all the time. It's a literal science, hard science, right? And then no student raises their hand. They say, no one's ever talked to me about making decisions. You know, and so that's a whole, like how do you frame a decision? What's your kind of cognitive process in that? How do you incorporate your thoughts and feelings with actual data from the career about outlook and salary and things like that? So it's really trying to like teach skill building, and not like you should be this or you should be that, because like you said, you're going to change throughout your career. Like this, you know, the averages show that people have, you know, 8 to 12 different jobs in their career, and they might even shift like actual careers 2 or 3 times in a lifetime. So that's just bound to happen. So
yeah,
you need the skills to be able to navigate that, not just like, here's something to tell you what you should do.
Yeah. I mean, I can't agree with you more on that. I'm just thinking back. I mean, I have a daughter, she's, you know, 16, and she's getting ready in a couple of years, she'll be going to college. And I think for like most people, it's like, okay, you graduate from high school, you go to college, you get a job. But along the way, if the parents aren't actively trying to engage and giving, you know, your child or even yourself ever being given that opportunity when you were younger, yeah, to make decisions, and the effects from the decision that you make, like where is that learned at is what I'm saying. It's like a trial and error. And then some people figure it out a lot earlier, and then some people figure out a whole lot later. And so I'm just feeling all of that, because I really feel like that is how you give a student a holistic experience in education, as an institution that serves people on education.
Yeah, and you said something really. Oh, I'm sorry, Hong. Go ahead.
Oh no, go ahead. Go ahead.
You said something really important about decision making. It's because problem solving is just saying, okay, I've got a problem, and what should I do? And I'll do that, and it's done. And decision making is actually incorporating, like you said, like what's the impact of this decision? What have the consequences been? How is it fitting with the reason I even made the decision? Because presumably you were in touch with your values and like, you know, what was important to you when you made that decision. Is it like you thought it was? Like really evaluating the outcome of that decision. And then nobody talks about that. And that's where we get guilty about changing course or something. It's like, well, you know, I've done this and I can't change because I've made that big decision. And it's not a one-time deal. It's a cycle that you can keep kind of looping through. So, you know, I really appreciate what you said, is that we also have to teach people to say, hey, it's okay to evaluate and maybe shift course, even if it's just incrementally or a little bit or stacking things on. It's important to think of like what happens after you make a decision.
Yeah.
And that's the part that is, it's tough in terms of at school, when we're given problems or we're given things to solve, there is an answer, and you're working your way, figuring out a process to get to that answer. And in terms of the kind of decision making that we're touching on, there are multiple answers and they're all correct to a certain extent. So it's an assessment, like a 60-40, 70-30. And everybody, when we're trained growing up from jump to go for 100-0, and you're looking at a 60-40, and your heart does not want to do that to the 40, you know, or the 30, you know, like you want everyone to be happy. So it's hard to make those decisions and then own those decisions. So what happens on the other side is you always, you own it with a hedge, you know, like, well, we'll do this, but then we'll revisit, or we'll do this, and then we'll do this, and we'll do this, and then it becomes just muddled. So in terms of making a decision, owning it, stepping forward, that's a lifetime skill. That's something that, I mean, I'm not even sure. It's something that is not like taught in a process. It's something that you either stumble on or you don't almost. It's like, yeah, it's like black magic in a way, in some ways, but it's a tough nut to crack. But I was also going to say that I can absolutely vouch for your idea of skills, because I graduated with bachelor in philosophy, and that did not kind of lead me on the path I am on today, but via skills that I had picked up along the way, I was able to take up some other jobs that kind of built that back-end experience, allowed me to get a job in kind of a more technical field. So the idea of skills, I can also vouch for that. And yeah, absolutely.
I was going to ask you, Chris, isn't there a test that you guys like proctor to as well too, for students that are trying to figure out what is the best fit for their skill set or what they're passionate about? I keep hearing this test that's proctored. Can you speak a little bit on that?
Yeah. Well, one, I'm going to, I apologize, I'm going to have to correct you in that it's not a test.
Okay.
I mean that very lightheartedly, because that is like in the culture, that's what 100% of people say.
Yeah.
Right. But it's kind of like what we've just been talking about. There is no right or wrong to who you are. And so any of these, and so the way I'd like to call it is an assessment, right? Okay. Or a self-assessment. And each one of the self-assessments is kind of has a foundation of a career theory. Like, okay, it's good if somebody understands what their interests are, and then I create a system that connects that to specific interest areas in the environment, and that's going to help somebody like simplify this process, right? And so you have things like the strong interest inventory or the Myers-Briggs type indicator. And then our counselors use those ideas even, you know, separate from the assessment. It's an idea about how, like, for the Myers-Briggs is a personality preference. And it's like how you kind of like operate in this world. And to some degree, that's innate. And some degree, it's learned. And it helps in that the skill, the competency I was speaking of, that self-assessment competency that you need to have. You need to be self-aware. You need to understand, you know what your interests are and where you're going, and that's a skill. And these are tools to help you kind of like artificially, like, let's just look at your interests, take those out, we're going to study those, and then we're going to stick them back into your whole life. Because, you know, back to the idea of holistic, there is no test or assessment that can tell you who you are. It can only work if you're saying, okay, I'm buying into their main idea here, that there is a connection between my interests and things that I'm going to be satisfied doing at work. If you don't buy into that, it ain't going to do you any good, right?
Yeah.
And if you're not understanding what the limits of such, you know, systems are, it's not going to do you much good, because you're going to be looking for an answer in it, and an answer isn't there. It's a tool, you know, and to be used and to incorporate new ideas. And then also, it's amazing in the kind of the database age, you know, then very quickly you can do assessment and then have like hundreds of examples of things that might be related to it. But everybody who is that like personality preference or personality code, they won't be interested in every same thing, right? Like because it depends on who you are and your background and your culture and your age and, you know, so many different factors. But those are very great tools to help people kind of start to come to grips with like some of the vocabulary. It's a great way of like talking about yourself and about what you're interested in, what they might be connected with. And it's a great momentum into like taking a deeper dive into, you know, what's out there and how it kind of connects with yourself. The best tool for the Career Center, it's called Eureka. It's a free tool for students. The Career Center pays for it. And you can access it online 24/7. So that's become our main kind of assessment tool. And the thing I like about that is it's 100% free for students.
So touching real quick on it, you mentioned what is out there. I mean, do you have any sense of what is out there for young folks today? Because it just seems like there's a lot of gig economy stuff. There's a lot of temporary kind of short-term jobs. But in terms of starting a career for a young person today, I mean, do you have any kind of tips or advice in that kind of respect, or is it just kind of always shifting?
I think what you're getting at is, like, you know, you can look at things and say, hey, what are the kind of hot careers in a specific area, which our area is a very interesting little bubble, you know, and you seriously do have to consider what is the environment going to give you. Like, and so again, that goes back to you being in touch with your values and saying, okay, living in Santa Barbara is my number one value. I've got family, I've got connections, I'm going to stay here. That kind of decision is going to impact the kinds of things you're going to be able to do. You know, like, yeah, you could be anything here. You could be a graphic designer, but probably better to be a graphic designer in Los Angeles or Long Beach or you know, a bigger city, you know. But now, you know, maybe things, you know, change all the time, like with the pandemic. Maybe, yeah, nobody needs to be anywhere and you do anything, you know, like this. But I take the approach, at least the kind of the moment that I'm working with students usually, is to take an approach of like, hey, let's find something that you want to do. You know, let's find something I struggle to use the word passion because it's so loaded. And sometimes, like you were referring to a little bit earlier, Pong, it doesn't have to be necessarily a passion thing that you're doing as a career. Some people, they get into that. Some people don't. Some people, their passion is on the outside of work. And, you know, there should be some of this kind of balance going on. But I really want them to say, hey, this is what I want to do. And can you make that work in Santa Barbara? And if you can't, do you want to consider going somewhere else? But also incorporate like labor market information and hot careers. But like you said, it's a dangerous track to like turn people on to, like, here are the top 10 careers in 2020. It's like, fine, that's an interesting bit of information, but what people read that as, here's the top 20 jobs you should consider doing, you know? And the thing is, we want the answer to this problem. We want somebody to answer it for us. We want it to be a for sure guarantee. And there is no guarantees, even in the hot careers, you know? And so it's a false hope. But again, you have to look at the data. You have to look at the labor market. You have to be in tune with those things, but it shouldn't be the thing that is, at least in my view, maybe I guarantee you there's other views on this, but like that in a community college setting, I want to see about, what are you interested in your education? What kinds of things might be related to that? How can you get engaged in maybe testing the waters in that with an internship or a mentor, and then focus on what are you going to do next, rather than what are you going to be doing in 10 years, you know, if you get this ideal career. So it's always just this tricky balancing act with the assessments and with labor market information, because people just want the answer. It's like, oh, you know, nursing's good. Okay, I'm going to do it. And that works for some people. A lot of people, it don't work at all.
Yeah. And then that even affects, I'm thinking about that nursing, because I've heard that so many times. There's so many jobs, it pays well. And then, like, they don't even really want to do the job. They just want to get the job, right? And so, you know, then you see people, you know, certain nurses in the hospital giving just horrible service. And that affects, it just trickles down from there, I feel, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's definitely dangers to both sides, because in terms of following your passion, I mean, when I got out of school, I wanted to do video games. So I went and worked in the video game industry for a couple of years. But the thing is, how that sausage is made, once you start getting, like, rubbing up against friction in that respect, then the passion part of it starts to wane. So then you start to not enjoy doing that as much as you did before you had the job. So there's pitfalls to both sides. Like, I know a bunch of people that went into art and writing after school, and the process of making money doing what you love and those avenues, it burned them out to a certain extent. So there's definite dangers to both sides. You don't want to chase the hot career just for money, because it's going to be, you know, pretty passionless there. But if you chase your passion and that gets rubbed the wrong way by certain decisions above you, then that goes bad too. So it's really just about finding that balance and realizing that, you know, the careers that you're looking for, I mean, you're really just looking for some security and comfort for yourself and for your family, whoever you're supporting. So you're looking for a nice balance. There's not going to be some 100% good answer. You're looking for like a decision-making scenario. You're looking for the 60-40, the 70-30 that is a little more beneficial to you than not, and you go that path. Because the 80-20, 90-10, they're super rare.
Exactly. And then don't get me wrong. I really believe we need to be talking about money. Like, we really need to be talking about this. This is a big factor in people not being able to be like socially mobile. We encourage people or just across the board in community colleges, we encourage people into programs that might not actually make them very much money. And we're telling them, hey, it's so good to be in school. It's so good to get your certificate. And you know, you should complete this. And they should. I'm not naysaying completing a certificate. But so many people don't go into that. They have no idea how much they're going to make in that, with that specific degree. None. No one's ever talked to them. No one's even, or locally. And then so we try to have some resources on that. We try to like say, hey, it's not superficial to be very focused on like how much are you going to get paid, because you need to be paid a living wage, and living wage is even too small. You need to be paid a family sustaining wage, and you need to have a plan to, and be encouraged to, and be supported to get those kinds of things. And so many students, they don't have those messages. They might have messages like, what are you doing in school? Get a job, you know? And if they're in school, and after they're done, they can make the same amount of money as they would have if they weren't in school. We've got problems there. We got to talk about, maybe we got to talk about, what do you stack on top of that after you get that the certificate? Let's talk about maybe stacking on the degree to that. Let's talk, maybe stack on, maybe talk about transfer or another degree that you can get to start trending upwards as far as how much money you're going to make. But at the end, so, like, believe me, like, it's ridiculous not to talk about money, especially around here. And it's a very rich conversation. It's not superficial at all. But then again, you need to, like you said, Hong, it's a percentage of how you make a decision, but you do need to know that information.
Yeah, absolutely. Poor first generation college student over here. Absolutely. That money conversation is a critical aspect of things. And something I was not aware of in college, because, you know, my bachelor's in philosophy, if I told my mom about that, she would have been, but I started as an engineer and couldn't cut it. So there's a lot of in between hedging and decisions that I had to make. And, you know, you make the best decision, you rely on some skills, and you do the best you can. The thing I was kind of mentioning, also thinking about also, is in terms of career paths, you know, with the gig economy, classically, like within the game industry, for example, where that I was in, you started as a tester and you worked your way up. And if you put in the time and you did the work, you would move up. And these gig economy jobs, there is no up. You just do the same job, you make the money, and it's just that transactional element of it. And that's it. And that's what kind of I feel is missing for a lot of entry-level jobs for young folks today, is a lot of them are built without that path, because that path has become too expensive to manage for some reason, or some analyst or stock broker doesn't think it's worth the expense to boost people up. But so you have a lot of these not quite dead end, but they don't go much of anywhere jobs. And so they're not like traps, because you do make money, but how do you get out of that circle, that, you know, that constant churn? It's an interesting place to be, just looking at what the market is like for young folks today.
Yeah. Or like you mentioned the video game industry, you get into like industries and all of a sudden you have like all this crunch that you got to do. And all of a sudden you're realizing, I got to work like 80 hours a week here. And that's oftentimes not ever explicitly stated, you know, and you ain't getting paid extra, but guess what? Your boss is in on Saturday and Sunday. And so are you. And then you start to get overwhelmed by the workplace culture, because you're nothing. You're just like somebody who's like a consultant, or like you said, gig economy. And then you start to see some serious abuses in like, especially in the, you know, video games and programming and like editing and things like that. It's rough.
I mean, I knew about the crunch, so I was kind of prepared. I mean, it was still rough. I mean, there were 24-hour shifts, there were 80-hour work weeks. There was, I mean, it was gnarly at times, but for the greater good and for the fact that folks are looking at you, and if you do a good job, they promote you. That was really important. But now a lot of times, I don't know. I mean, I've been out of the industry for over 10 years now, so I'm not sure if that tester path still even exists, because that was the entryway. If you love game, you start as a tester, you work your way up. Now, I mean, you have a lot of folks coming in with game design degrees, coming in with specific degrees targeted to that. So they come in right out of school and they're boosted up right away. So it creates, it's not only, not only that path might not be there, but then the schism that is presented by folks that are new out of school trying to get into that industry and right into that crunch. I mean, it's a lot to acclimate yourself to. You know, it's not an easy kind of thing to jump into an 80-hour work week coming out of school, hearing about it, and then doing it as another. You know, so there's a lot going on there. But yeah, it is definitely one of those things to consider.
One of the things that's like it's career counseling 101 essentially. Like it's like you learn this the first day of career counseling school is the idea of information interviews, is where you know you try to encourage people to reach out. To talk to people who are in, like, we'll stay with the video game example, like reach out to people who are actually in the video game industry. Now, sometimes there's barriers to that because they're working so much or they're hard to, whatever, like there's barriers in everything in life and you figure it out and you approach it. But the thing is, nobody knows, like, so how many, you know how many people go to law school and they have no idea what law school is like? You know, yeah. You know, people like end up like, yeah, going to nursing school. And they have no idea. They never talk to a nurse. They just, their aunt Mary just said, hey, you know, nursing's a good career. You should do it. And then you think you're done. You pat yourself on your back. I made the decision. Like I'm out. I did it all. But you need to talk to people. You need to try to like penetrate that, the culture of a workplace and understand, hey, what's your day like? You know, because, you know, it's funny because we put so much emphasis on getting a job, you know, like you got a good resume and you got to like train up on your interviewing. You got to do the research for the company. You got to do your LinkedIn networking, you know, like it's, the, you know, 99% of the focus is on getting the job. And then you get it and you're like, oh, this is hard. This is a lot harder than getting the job, in fact, you know? And so you got to like be thinking about that, like to like give some information about, well, what is this job? What are the problems of the job? What are the hours of the job? What are the pay of the job? And you can do that by talking to people who are doing it. But Akil and Hong, how many people think want to do this thing? Like, very yeah. few. You're like, oh, I'm going to yeah. bother them. They're too busy. They won't want to yeah. talk to me. Like, yeah. oh, that's yeah. what I'm talking yeah. about is about negative thoughts that actually change the direction of your life because you're like, I'm going to bother them. They don't want to talk to me. I'm just a City College student. And then you, by not doing something, you didn't get that information that might have changed the course of your career. So I'm trying to get people to reach out to people who are doing jobs, bring them on campus. That's because you can be like, you know, doing self-assessments all day long, but it's not until you start talking to people and figuring out how you might fit in somewhere that it really opens up. And then you're making networks, and then you're making connections, and then people send you things about internships. Like it, you got to talk to people. That's maybe my number one, you know, thing, you know, to suggest to people is get out of your bubble and your comfort zone and start talking to people who are doing things you want to do.
That's on that point. It made me think about the younger generation, you know, how, you know, in some ways, in some regards, you know, like everything is on their phone, you know what I mean? And I wonder if that ever poses challenges for them too, in terms of you're just coming out of high school, you're 18 years old. You got, and people are like, look, you need to reach out and communicate. You know, I wonder if that, I don't know if, I don't want to say handicaps them or in some ways, but I mean, definitely the impact of, you know, cell phone use and not being able to actually engage with them, with people. I wonder if that plays a part of that as well.
Well, I mean, I think that's a whole avenue that you should pursue is like things on your phone too. You know, like you can do a lot with LinkedIn. LinkedIn is amazing. I mean, you can network, you can search for jobs, you can like tend to your site and express your interests and the things that your site excited about on your site. And then when you're truly expressing those interests and passions, other people connect with that. And it's kind of amazing how, what a great tool that can be and how that can lead to in-person contact as well. Like, so you know, exactly, you got to figure out what's your way into it and then train people to be authentic to themselves. Like, I think sometimes when you say like networking, people think like, hey, I'm Chris, here's my card. Yeah, and we're going to do great. got five goals that I want to accomplish, you know? Like, no, it does not have to be like that. You try to find out how are you going to do your authentic networking and who you're going to do that with. And, you know, it takes some thought and some, hopefully some support from, you know, career center kinds of activities.
See, that's some old school approach, though. Like, that's when you said that, I was like, yeah, that's the old school. Like, that's kind of like generational, how you grew up, where you go in, and you're like, hey, my name's Akil, I'm this, I'm that. And it's probably not like that anymore.
But it isn't.
Yeah, I feel like young folks there are a little better at that networking than I was. I mean, I grew up thinking about the meritocracy still. I was like, if you do work hard, do your job, do your best, they will look at you, and they will look at you as a good person and move you up. You know, I didn't realize that a lot of it was a sham. You know, like it is networking. My sisters were always telling me, you got to network, you got to do this, make connections, always be. And I'm like, connections? I'm focused on being the best worker I can be. You know, I'm keeping that machine chugging. They'll just look at me and realize how good of a job I'm doing, and I don't have to worry about networking. You're crazy. I mean, because they worked in TV and stuff. So I was like, oh, that's just a Hollywood thing. That's some entertainment nonsense. Networking, I do this kind of work. They look at my work. And you know what? They don't look at my work. I mean, they do. But if it gets done and done well, that's all that matters. And so we're, you know, like, so that aspect of it. And see, I'm no social media, no LinkedIn, no anything, and I'm still that way to my detriment, probably. But you know, it's one of those things where I've seen that, where it, once again, back to balance, this holistic approach. It's not all about meritocracy work. It's not all about networking connections. Because if you got a great network and great connections, but you don't do the work, you're not going anywhere either. So you need that balance. You need the skills and the networking. It's got to be the total package, which is why, you know, the things are the way they are, where even college admissions, if you don't have the clubs, if you don't have this, they want that total package. It's not always the best way to evaluate, if we're being completely honest, but at the same time, it's, you know, it's the problem, the decision-making, going back to the decision-making we were discussing before.
So. Yeah, you need to be the total package, or be able to bribe people with large amounts of
money. have money. That's always an option.
I'm curious. I have one more question. Do we have time for that?
Of course.
Yeah. I'm curious to know, like, how did you end up at Santa Barbara City College, and what was your path, Chris?
Well, I was a student before I was an employee. And I was in the culinary program at Santa Barbara City College.
Really?
Back in the day. I won't even drop the year. And that was, it was kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier, like food and cooking have been a passion of mine for a long time, like way before there was like food television shows, you know. Like I remember when I was a kid on the Discovery Channel, there was like Great Chefs of the World show, and it was the first time I ever seen a cooking show, and it just blew me away. I just loved it, and you know, it started a long history of just being, you know, passionate about food and cooking and the, you know, techniques. And so of course I'd go to culinary school, but no thanks. I decided that was my passion and my hobby and for my family and for my friends. And, you know, I decided, I did work in the industry, you know, for some time, but I decided that it wasn't quite, you know, what I was after. And I've always was just kind of a seeker, and like, I want to do something that I'm passionate about. I don't ever thought I could do the same thing for my whole life. I think I'm kind of like restless in a way. And it connected a lot with career counseling. Hung, like you, I had a undergrad in history and a bunch of philosophy classes and religious studies classes and you know, things like that. And I will say that a liberal arts education can make you money. Sometimes the curve is a lot slower as you're going up to making a good wage than if you're an engineer or, you know, accounting or something like that. But you can make good money with being a philosophy or history, you know, background. You can do it. And it always irks me when people say there's only like four majors you should ever even consider enrolling in. You know, that's just, you know, that's your opinion. But so I ended up, you know, focusing on counseling, and ended up transferring to UCSB, ended up pursuing a master's degree in counseling psychology. And I did an internship at Santa Barbara City College, which, you know, I had been a student. I did an internship at the Career Center. And out of that internship, I got my first job in the field at University of Oregon. I worked there for about 5 years. And then the director position came up at SBCCC, or one too many C's there. I somehow, it must have been a weak pool, and I got in. And I've been, so I think it's, gosh, it's been like, that was like 16 years ago now.
Are you from the area originally, Chris?
I'm from Los Angeles. I grew up in Inglewood, California, in Los Angeles, and moved here for college.
Yeah, and Inglewood has changed a lot recently. They got the new stadium. The Clippers want to build their facility there. The Forum has been remodeled. So, yeah, it's –
Yeah, I grew up a stone's throw away from the fabulous Forum. I grew up going to Laker games, Magic Johnson era. Like, I handed out towels to Byron Scott because he went to the YMCA I worked in. Like, yeah, man, the Forum, oh, I love the Forum. And
the Great Western Forum.
The Great Western Forum.
Great Western Bank sponsored, yep.
Well, before that, it was the Fabulous Forum.
It was the Fabulous Forum.
The Great Western came in as a sponsor,
Yeah, it's really nice now. If you've been recently to the show or anything, like, they really gussied it up. So it's pretty nice.
Man, I saw, I'm going to date myself, but I saw Belvedere DeVoe, Keith Sweat, and Johnny Gill at the Forum. With Eli, wow. I was Eli up in the OPS. We went to that concert back in the day, man.
Offline, I'd like to hear some stories about that.
Oh, man. Yes, offline, definitely.
Yeah, because Inglewood was definitely some – the realness was on full force in Inglewood, man. Oh, yeah.
Quick plug for the movie The Wood. I don't know if you've seen that, but I'm sure both of you guys have. But, that movie's great.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
I love watching like 70s movies. There's a lot of like that filmed in Los Angeles. Like I'll be watching them and I'll recognize like the street, you know, like Manchester or Sepulveda, and like they're, you know, going down the street. And it's like, I know that there's you know, Danny's Donuts or like whatever. Yeah. I just get this great sense of like nostalgia from like seeing like LA in the 70s, you know. It's just it's so different. It's just, it's incredible.
I just wish there was a point where I at some point I would transition and feel like a Santa Barbara local, but I don't think it's been long enough for me. I don't have that. It's just, I feel like I need to know more. Like there's a test, not a test, but like a, you know, yeah. I don't know
what you just start complaining about Cox Cable and
yeah,
like, can't park at Trader Joe's or whatever. Yeah, and then all of a sudden you're just like, you're a local, you know?
Yeah, that's real. That's real.
Okay. I can get with that. I guess that's a nice segue into our food section though. Anyone want to lead us off in terms of things we've been eating or things we've been doing lately? I can start if we'd like. I know going into this, Chris wanted to talk about some home cooking stuff. So I wanted to lead off with something I made recently that I didn't grow up with, even though it is a kind of a Hong Kong Cantonese staple, of Coca-Cola wings. Basically, it's like a braised style chicken. I love wings, always loved wings my whole life. Mostly just had the deep fried buffalo style. So the braised wing is something that I grew up with my mom making. And I guess in Hong Kong, when they first introduced Coca-Cola in the, I want to say 70s or 80s, folks started using it as like a simple syrup kind of thing. So they pour it into the braise and just use that as the braising fluid. And so, yeah, what you do, basically you get wings, you fry them on both sides. They're crispy. You throw Coke in there, you braise it down till it's just almost nothing. Then you turn the heat to high, toss them in that thick syrup that's left, and then serve as is. There's a lot of posts online about kids growing up nostalgic for the Coca-Cola wings that their parents were making like as a treat. So I'm Cantonese ethnicity, but my mom didn't really do that growing up. So I wanted to try it, and they are delicious. Absolutely. I mean, you could probably do the same thing with any sort of teriyaki or any kind of just thick sugar based kind of sauce. But as a quick, I mean, I was thinking about this, and there's those kind of simple one kind of like quick to prepare dishes in every culture. Like in college, someone showed me like the cream of mushroom soup with a hamburger patty and rice. You know, it's a similar kind of thing where it's really good, really filling, and not hard to make. So yeah, all you need is chicken wings, can of Coke. You can add whatever other seasoning you want, garlic, soy sauce, whatever else you think would be good with it. But you throw the chicken in there, throw the Coke in there, put a lid on it, come back when it's reduced, and then toss it up and serve it, and that's it. So it's a really nice dish. Now, I'll put a recipe in the show notes.
Oh, and that sounds so good. And I think, you know, people use Coke for cooking more often than you'd think, you know. Like the other thing is Coke is so acidic.
The toilet cleaner?
Yeah. Well, it breaks down like the proteins of meats and makes it really tender. It's a lot of barbecue if you're doing a wet, you know, rub, or, you know, there's Coke in it, and it's just the sugar. And then, you know, if you're ever in a lab and you do like an acidic test on a Coca-Cola, it's like, oh, I'm drinking that.
Oh, yeah. Those YouTube videos where they put the tooth in it, and then a week later, there's like nothing left. But yeah, that's the first time I heard, was people used to tell me pour Coke down the toilet when I'm cleaning a toilet or something. That, and I was like, what are you, but I love to drink this stuff. I'm not going to waste it like that, but it does work. So, you know.
Yeah, that makes me not want to drink Coke. I'm like.
I drink a lot of seltzer now, and I wonder about the carbonation effect with just no sugar added seltzer. Like, am I doing any harm to myself that way? I don't know, but I can't help it. It's like the nicotine patch for my soda addiction, you know, because I used to be a soda junkie. Like, I was drinking unbelievable amounts of the stuff. But switching to seltzer, I've been able to cut it out and just switch to seltzer. But I know there's probably still bad stuff there too, but I can't help myself.
Everything we do is bad for us, you know?
It's just balance. Balance and moderation. That should be a theme of this episode, is a holistic approach. Find that balance. Find things, you know, the 60-40, 70-30 decision-making, you know? Absolutely.
All jokes aside, I couldn't agree with you more. And that's the goal, right? Is finding some balance, and it seems harder and harder to do.
Yeah.
What about you, Akil?
Well, I'm gonna piggyback off of Hong, because maybe about, I think it was about a couple of weeks ago. I think it was beginning of September. You know, my family and I, we usually go to the LA markets or the Korean or the Japanese markets. And usually stockpile for the month. So we do it usually every month. And this time, I hadn't been going to the food court just because, you know, the whole COVID situation. And, this time I was like pretty hungry. So I was like, look, I'm going to stop and get something. Well, was looking at the, you know, the traditional Korean food, like the bibimbap and the japchae and all that. But I ran into, in the food court, there was a restaurant called Gentle Chick. And they specialized in chicken and fried chicken. So I got two things. I got a chicken sandwich. It was a waffle chicken sandwich, which was like crazy good. On the outside, in lieu of the bread, they did the waffles. The chicken was obviously fried, and then it had like a spicy sauce on it with cabbage, and that was really good. I sent a picture to Hong. He was like, "Yo, where you at?
I need to know. It looked incredible." Chicken and waffles is that kind of thing, you know. It's like an LA thing, so it's.
But was it bone-in chicken?
The sandwich wasn't, but what I really want to rave about was the wings, because I got, I can't go to a wing joint and not get wings. I'm a wing dude too. And then when I say wing, I mean wings, like no gristle, like just leaving the bone. Some people are like, I'm a wing person, and then you watch them eat, and you see all the cartilage, you see the gristle. I'm like, nah, you're not a wing person, my man. I am a wing dude, and so I got – it's a Korean-owned company, and it was – they're called Korean fried wings, and it was like – I think they do them in, like, rice flour, and I got – is that right, Hong? Go ahead.
Jump it in. Can fluctuate. It's like – a lot of times, like, potato starch, wheat flour. I mean, Korean chicken is kind of having a moment, and the thing about it is not just the breading, but they fry it twice. It's like the Belgian-style fry that's fried twice. They do a quick fry, and they do a second fry for that extra crispiness. So it's just shatteringly crispy.
Man, it was all that crispy on the outside, moist, juicy on the inside, and the flavoring was real good. I there's, you know, like sometimes like it's overwhelming for me when I go to the wing spots because there's like 20 different options, and it's just, and then there's different ranges of heat and all that. So I just asked the guy, I'm like, hey, tell me what's good, pick it out. So I don't even really remember what flavor it was, but it was like a, I know it was like a, it was, I remember chili coming through, garlic coming through, and man, like, I'm not even going to lie. When we get paid next week, I'm going back. I'm going back, man. Those wings are good. Like, one of the best wings I've ever had. Gentle Chick. I don't even think they have a website. I just think it's a mom and pop shop in the Galleria in Northridge in the Korean market area, just in the food court. So I've been trying to find a website. I didn't see anything on them, but I've seen like there's reviews on them on Yelp and stuff like that. On
the Yelp page, yeah.
Yeah, but I didn't find an actual website. So that is a good sign of them being authentic too as well, was when you can't find a website for them.
But how does their chicken sandwich compare with the Popeyes fried chicken sandwich?
You know what? Here's my thing on the Popeyes fried chicken sandwich. I tried it. It wasn't that good to me, my opinion. And the reason why is because Popeyes, like, they're not consistent. At least my experience with Popeyes, sometimes you can go, it can be really good. And sometimes it can just be horrible. And I went on a horrible day, and cause it just, I didn't think it was that good, you know, but by far this place is better. People are sleeping on Korean fried chicken, y'all, man. Like if you haven't been, I mean, I know Han knows, but there's like Korean fried chicken is a real thing. And even Japanese fried chicken is a real thing.
And they have a ton of chains in there. There's like Kyochan, Banchan, there's a ton in LA. They just opened one in Isla Vista, Vaughn's Fried Chicken. I mean, you look it up and you're like, Vaughn's, but yeah, I guess it's from San Jose. They opened up, it's a Korean style fried chicken place there where they're doing the whole bird and the wings and stuff. So that's the only place I know of in town so far that's doing Korean fried chicken here. But yeah, for that twice fried, super crispy kind of effect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like slap your mama good. But I won't slap my mama because my mama doesn't play like that. But I'm just saying, like, you know, it's just worth this type of expression. It is that good. So if you guys ever find yourself in Northridge, in the valley, it's called the Galleria. That's like the shopping mall, actually. Right when you walk in, it's on the left-hand side. Man, do yourself a favor.
Nice.
What do you have for us, Chris?
So, you know, the main thing I've been doing this summer and kind of in through the pandemic, really, is I've been doing sourdough bread. Mm. And I definitely bake quite a bit, just always. I was one of my jobs before this job, I was a baker. I was trained by a master French baker who was literally certified by the country of France as a master baker, and learned how to make a Levain style of like kind of sour. It's sourdough bread. It's just the French way of saying it. And, you know, I did that for a while and I really enjoyed it. Some of my best memories of that job, you know, were like at like 3 a.m, breaking into a warm loaf of bread, having some stinky French cheese and a glass of wine at 3 a.m. It's the best thing ever. You know, it was incredible. Yeah. You're so tired. You're like hallucinating and you're working so hard. And, but bread is a love of mine. And I got back into it. I'd make loaves, but I didn't have a sourdough starter. It's something you kind of got to like feed and you got to like take care of and baby it. And I just kind of didn't have the time for it, but now I do. It's just like with any kind of like even fried chicken, the rabbit hole you can go down, the different ways to do it, the techniques, the styles, like so guys, I'm actually like buying like 50-pound bags of flour from like artisan flour mills in Petaluma, California. I don't know what the mailman thinks I'm doing in here, but that's the kind of thing I'm doing. I'm getting the good ingredients. I took me, you know, a couple weeks to create my own sourdough starter. So it's a perfect time because, you know, you realize like these national supply food supply chains, they break down very quickly in a bad situation like this. Like you couldn't find flour on the shelves. You couldn't find a commercial yeast on the shelf. And so I took a step back and I was just like, wow, this is worse than not having toilet paper. I can't get any flour. And so I went down. So I made a wild sourdough starter. So there's yeast in the air, right? It just lives in the air. It's on our skin. Different regions have different species of yeasts. And all you do is you add flour and water together. In my case, I also added a bag of grapes, red organic unwashed grapes, because there's yeast cultures on the grape skin too. And it's this incredible process of it just turns into this beautiful smelling, wonderful ooze of a thing. But like through that process, part of it in the time you're thinking, okay, this is going to kill somebody. It's so disgusting. But then it kind of like it evolves into this beautiful natural way to leaven bread. And so I don't use any commercial yeast at all. And I'm making beautiful like sourdough loaves and other things. You know, I made a dark chocolate cherry sourdough loaf. Ooh. That kind of blew away the you know, the best thing about making bread too is like you can't eat it all, so you've got to give it to people. So you know, making a habit of riding my bike over to my friend's house in Carpinteria and dropping off a loaf of dark cherry, you know, chocolate Levon is you're pretty popular, you know, in the town. So and then it's just been an amazing thing to focus on. There's something wonderful about making bread, because a lot of times when I make bread, it's like a 3-day process. You feed the starter enough where it's going to be ready for bread. Then you mix the bread and you proof it on the second day. And then and let it like sit for maybe about 12 to 20 hours. And then on the third day, you're taking those things and you're putting them in the oven and you're making a loaf. And I think especially in this pandemic, like having these little like capsules of time that I felt like, hey, I'm doing something. I can see the end of it and there's a process. And at the end, there's an actual product that you can, you know, get excited about and love and smell. And so it's been a obsession, maybe is fair to say.
Well, it's just to let you know, I'm in Carp too. I'm going to shoot you a text. My address, come through.
Please do, because actually I saw you walking down Linden the other night and I said, oh, you must live in Carp now. And so like I need to know this, Akil. So like,
yeah, man. Send to we're me neighbors.
It's happening. Yeah.
So what makes the bread sour, just for a layman to ask? Is it a layperson? Is it the fermentation of the sourdough starter, or is there something you add to it?
No, it's purely so. When what you have in a sourdough starter is water, flour, yeast, and beneficial bacteria. And what they eat is the sugar in flours, in the flour that you're putting in. And they react to different flours in different ways. So like a unbleached white flour versus a rye flour or a whole wheat. They have different kind of like ways they respond. And then they say something about feeding a starter, you put in more flour and water, and then the yeast and the beneficial bacteria, they start to eat that up. They're having their lunch and they're feeling strong. And that's when you see the byproduct of that eating that is gases and other things that actually make the dough rise. It's your leaven. And then there's a taste factor in this too. And so some people use a young sourdough starter, which has maybe just been fed and left to sit for maybe a few hours. And then you're going to get a barely perceptible, almost nutty kind of sourdough flavor. You might not even associate it with sourdough at all. Now, if you let that go longer, there's going to be more byproducts from the yeast being fed, and then there's going to be more flavor. And then if you let it go long enough where it peaks, and then it starts to go down, that's when you start to get a little bit of the funkiness from the byproduct of the yeast. And that's when it gets sour. And then it can get way too sour that it isn't very palatable. So it's really about time and temperature and when you're deciding. And then also how much starter you choose to use will impact the flavor of that sour flavor.
That's a science. I got one question about that. So if you're gluten intolerant, I heard you can actually eat sourdough, right? Fresh sourdough.
Well, you know, I'm not a doctor. I just play one on TV, so I don't want to give any medical advice. But that's what they say, right? They say, because yeah. You know, like I'm saying, this is a 3-day process. The sourdough starter is alive, and it will stay alive for the rest of my life if I take care of it. And you know what? I totally lost the train of my thought. What was your question?
About gluten-free. Can you?
That's right. And so the slower rise, the slower process, as opposed to like an industrial process, is supposed to make the gluten more tolerable for people who are, you know, intolerant to it. I mean, because gluten is, you know what gluten is? It's a byproduct of flour and water. That's it. It's a protein chain that happens when flour and water get mixed together. And then industrial, like baking, they really force that issue, and it's much harder to digest. And, you know, most, like, you go to Trader Joe's and you buy sourdough, turn it around, look at the ingredients list. It's going to have something in there that says dough conditioner. And we are, like, right on the face of it, you know, that's not a good thing. Like, whatever that, it's a natural thing, but that's what makes a commercial loaf of bread taste sour, not a sourdough starter. No commercial bread loaf, even though they say sourdough, they use dough conditioner that it gives that little acidic tanginess, but it's not real. And so, and that again is just like, it's harder to digest. It's not good. It's not good for anybody, really.
There's a show on Netflix that I think it's called Air. What's the name of that? It's like Air, Water, and Fire, I think. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, he talks about baking. That's really cool.
Yeah, he was talking about baking and stuff like that. I thought that was a pretty good show.
And the
sourdough.
Sourdough's having a moment too, where a lot of pizza folks are doing sourdough based crusts, and sourdough bread loaves are just everyone's baking at home. So it's a nice time to kind of brush up on the kind of basics, and this is a good, very good fundamental breakdown. It makes me want to go try to bake a loaf myself. But yeah,
no, not me. I just want to eat it, Chris.
I think a lot of people get turned off by, you know, and it's true to some degree, about that, you know, that it's a science and that it's like, it's this strict, but in a lot of ways it's not, you know, like you're dealing with a living thing, kind of a living entity. And sometimes, like, if the day is like 80 degrees outside, that living thing is going to act differently than if it's 65 degrees. You have different flowers that absorb water differently. You have different flowers that have different levels of protein in it. And so to be a good baker, you also have to experiment. You have to, like, understand, like, the fundamentals of why you're doing something, but then you have to be able to adjust it if it ain't working, you know? So, like, there is, like, a craft and a feel to it, though I also have a scale, and, like, I'm weighing my ingredients instead of using measuring cups, you know? Like, so there is a science to it, but then you also, there's an art and a feel to it, which I think gets me more excited about it. And there's a creativity to it, and there's a learning curve, you know, which is so exciting. It's fun to get online, and, you know, I listen to podcasts on making bread and blogs and talking with people in the community, and it's just amazing how passionate. And like you said, Hong, like, everybody's doing it now because it's like, oh, you know, I want to make bread, but you can't buy yeast, you know, you can't get flour and all that stuff. And I make a lot of pizzas with it too. I make pizzas probably like, dude, I asked my family, it's like, is it okay if I make pizza again? It's like, I literally live off of it.
And they'll never say no. Pizza's always good.
Well, I got teenagers, so they're good at saying no.
All right. And that brings us to our, speaking of teenagers, just, you know, our third part of the show, or last part of the show, which is our culture section. Anyone want to kick us off?
Well, I'm going to take the guest privilege of going second or third, because that, I don't know, like, that sounds like a like, you guys are going to sound like, I don't know, I don't think I'm very cool, you know, so I don't know if, like, I'm going to have some hot takes on cultural.
And that's why we do this, is because everyone, like we were talking about earlier, everyone as an individual is different. So the things that affect you profoundly, I mean, you never know what it's going to be with the individual that you talk to. And the thing for folks that are listening who might not know about something that really affected you, and they pick it up and it affects them in a similar kind of way, that's kind of what we're going for here, where we're kind of just kind of shining a light on things that maybe people might not know about, or if they do, then they can vibe with it too. But everyone's answer is like, always good and correct, so you'll never have a problem there, you know. So
that's right, the vibe. I totally feel it. Yeah,
I'll kick it off then. All right, my pick for this week is a book. It's a breezy book because it's quick to read because it's a mix of images and words. Marshall McLuhan, 1967, wrote a book called "The Medium Is the Massage." And I think the original title was "The Medium Is the Message," but I mean the urban legend around it was it came off the printing press with an error. Massage instead of message, and he went with it anyway because in a lot of ways it does fit kind of the story, the point of the book, which is that it's not just the message that is important in what people are doing, it's the medium that is transmitted upon. And he goes back as far as the mention of the wheel, you know, to the typewriter. I mean, the book was written in the 60s, so he was primarily speaking about television and radio, but he is also famous for coining the term global village. Because he saw the effect that these kind of technologies would have in terms of like radio and television, you're transmitting messages and signals a lot farther out. So that in terms of what used to be like a local transmission, in terms of you would get into like a discussion circle in your local town or neighborhood, has now become like a city circle, a state circle, a country circle, and now a global circle. So he, you know, the term global village. And in terms of speaking, talking about television in the 60s, how prescient it is in terms of how far we've gone down this path. You know, there's a famous quote in the book that, you know, that all media work us over completely. They're so pervasive in their personal, political, economic, aesthetic, psychological, moral, ethical, and social consequences, they leave no part of us untouched, unaffected, unaltered. You know, and he's talking about television and radio. So yeah, in terms of how much farther that has gone, you know, you felt that then, and now that we are like exponentially more kind of ingrained in the media, because you know, the fact that it does come in on digital screens is different than if all these things that are being spit out there were just on typewritten pages that we got in the mail, or in a book that was released every 3 months. The fact that it is also instant and pervasive and all encompassing, like, you know, like there's, you know, like the, you can see how not only the message is important, but the media that is transmitted on and the ramifications of that media are so important as well. So I think that was a good point for the book to make. And the way they do it in the book is by they had a visual artist work on kind of some a representation of things. So when you're reading the book, there are images that you read. There are words that are used as images. I mean, it's kind of a really cool kind of like media analysis, and just kind of, it's a cool book to go through. And it's quick. You can read it in a morning, afternoon easily. So yeah, Medium is the Massage by Marshall McLuhan. That's my pick for this episode. Nice. Yeah, it's something that it's just gets kind of we're more aware of it now, but it's always something to think about in terms of always not just what you're saying, but where you're saying it on. Like those ideas of maybe you shouldn't say that on the internet. I mean, that's absolutely a valid thing to kind of consider. Like there's always things to be said, but maybe not on the internet, or maybe not in the written page that you're turning in as an assignment, or maybe not here or there. The media that you transmit is very important, especially in this interconnected global village that we are now all in.
Yeah, and even more so kind of how politically polarized we are, how like more than ever specific media outlets like represent your social political views because you're consuming or you're presenting on that media. Like if you're, you know, if you're on Facebook or if you're on Fox News or you know, whatever they are, like it's like we have these like cultural decisions about what you're representing because you're on such a platform. And social media, like if you plug social media into that book, I'm sure it's just, it's right in.
Yeah, they had that Netflix show, The Social Dilemma, that came out recently, and that kind of speaks on and the algorithm that bookend that is in the back end of a lot of this stuff is absolutely part of that conversation. The algorithm has fundamentally changed in terms of the reward receptors that it fires upon in our brains to make us keep scrolling and keep scrolling. I mean, that's absolutely a big part of why media today is so kind of like earwormy and how and why we're so unable to come to consensus. Because if I don't agree with you, I don't have to try to work with you to come to agreement. I can just retreat farther back into my wormhole, and there's plenty of people around here that agree with me just fine. So, you know, I don't need to even work on that. So those are kind of interesting conversations to have going forward. And that doesn't even touch on the like the bullying, the direct, all the DM stuff that goes on that we don't even, that has nothing to do with the algorithm and just has to do with humans interacting with each other and, you know, trolling and being mean to each other. So yeah, it's a loaded kind of media world we live in right now for sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right.
All right, Chris.
I watched a TV, like a mini series that I loved. It was called Devs. Have either of you seen that?
I haven't heard about it.
Is maybe
one
of my favorite shows. Is directed and written by Alex Garland. So I'm a huge like sci-fi nerd kind of guy, but this one kind of looks at. It's kind of like in the Silicon Valley, or at least an alternate universe, Silicon Valley, and a big internet company. And it dives into kind of quantum physics and philosophy and spirituality and kind of the theory of everything. And it is moody and nerdy, and just the acting is just on point, and really for like a sci-fi nerd like me, like gets you thinking about things. And I was engaged from the first minute to the last minute. It was just incredible.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to check it out, but Alex Garland directed Ex Machina, which is, you know, an excellent movie, and then also Annihilation, which I really liked. But was a lot more mysterious in terms of there's a lot to kind of unpack in that movie as well. So I was definitely, it was on my radar, but I totally forgot about it. So I'm glad you mentioned it, because I do want to check it out.
Yeah, I loved Annihilation. And I think there's some of those vibes of that mystery and just that brooding kind of like slow pace of like you're not sure where this is going or what's happening. And the music is fantastic, some great like moody synth music, and it's just so good. I love it.
Yeah, because Ex Machina is a definite vibe, and you know, but it has, the narrative flow is pretty straightforward to a certain extent. Annihilation, like it started straightforward, and then it just went every which way, and then by the end I was like, okay, I need to watch that again like right away to try to unpack some of the things, to try to figure out, you know, just kind of what's going on. But I think that was kind of intentional, that they want to leave it, some things a little open-ended, you know.
I agree. I think sci-fi has improved, you know, once you start answering all the questions, it's like, yeah, this isn't that good, is it?
Yeah. Yeah. Sci-fi was really a lot of universe creation before, and now they're leaving a lot more into the hands of the experiencer, the viewer. So that I do enjoy that aspect, because the world that is created after the film or after the show, where all this fan fiction and things of that sort, where people are just expanding and building these universes. I think that's a cool aspect of definitely the modern sci-fi world we live in. And the fact that it's actually acceptable to be into that stuff. Because as someone who was both fat and into nerdy stuff before it was cool, like the slings and arrows that I had to bear throughout my life for liking certain things or being a certain way, which are now okay, absolutely. It's like, oh, I'm glad I made it to this other side. You know? It's nice over here.
Well, I'm with you, Hong. You'll have to help me develop into a higher level of human being, because I think I'm still slinking around being shameful about you know, playing video games and watching nerdy sci-fi movies, but I do.
Oh, yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I still remember. We had a friend whose brother had a Boys to Men CD in his CD collection, and that was enough to be like, your brother listens to, but not even him, his brother. Your brother listens to Boys to Men. You really want to hang out with the punks right now? I don't think so. And you know, stuff like that. I didn't talk about like the comics I was into, like all the video games I played. Like it was like many faces to many people. I had to put on different faces to other people. I mean, the fat thing, that was just rough, because I can't hide that. I can't pretend I'm skinny to anybody. But I mean, at least the stuff I'm into, I can hide. But yeah, now we're in the grand scheme of things, a much more accepting world, and a world where I mean, I guess the Marvel Universe is the reason for it. I don't know, but everyone's much more into all this kind of stuff. So not even just like minds, but just people that are okay with whatever. Even if you're not a like mind, it's like, oh, it's cool. It's all good.
You know? Exactly. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So is that on Netflix, Chris?
It's on Hulu. It's on Hulu. Hulu like original or whatever.
Okay, I'll have to look for that.
It's real good. I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, nice. So I mean, and Alex Garland has a pretty decent following now, and I can't believe it slipped off my radar. So thank you very much for mentioning that. Absolutely.
Man, listen, no joke, man. Boys to Men was everything to me back in the day.
Oh, and that's the thing. Who didn't have a graduation or whatever where they play like End of the Road, you know, or On Bended Knee at the Slow Dance? Like, those are just like jams. I mean, you know what I'm talking about? Motown Philly.
Motown
all
Philly.
All the fast-paced stuff. Like, yeah. That's a Hall of Fame, like some of the best vocalists of all time. So like, and now we can talk about that and be like, oh, there is no more, like everything is one genre. Music is music. But before then, back then it was very segmented. Like even metal kids and punk kids didn't get along. And metal and punk, they're like next door neighbors, you know? Like,
yeah, so it's right. Like,
how can you be getting into fist fights about the nuances between, I mean, talk about nerds. You're fighting each other over nuances and style that is literally like, you know, like 20 beats per minute and that's it, you know? So.
Well, yeah. There was always that classic argument about Boyz II Men or Jodeci. What type of person are you? And if you pick Jodeci, you were a certain kind of person. If you pick Boyz II Men, you were a different type of person. So, oh, yeah.
Yeah, we have that career assessment at the Career Center.
You know, I was funny thinking about the assessment, the career assessment. It'd be kind of funny to do during like an in-service, you know, to people who are already, you know, employed, because there's a lot of people probably in a field that, you know, they're, you know, that they think that they enjoy doing, but maybe it's not a good match. You know, it's kind of be kind of fun to do that.
Oh, I thought you were gonna have in service where we're gonna ask Boyz II Men or Jodeci and people get into two circles. And then you had what about Casey and JoJo? And that's like a small little group, like, oh, I love the song with Tupac, you know, like
I think Dr. G would be Boyz II Men. That's funny. So I guess my piece that I want to share with everyone is I started a new series. It's called Lovecraft Country. It's a new series that's on HBO. It's an American horror drama film. The series was developed by, I think her name is Misha Green, but it's based upon a 2016 novel entitled Lovecraft Country. And it's about, it takes place in the 50s, which is the segregated 50s. And it's about a young black man who is basically travels across the segregated United States in search of his missing father, and as well as learning like dark secrets, plaguing a town in which the famous horror writer, H.P. Lovecraft, had based the location of his various tales. So it's a really, really good series. Like, this is not my typical genre of what I would enjoy or get into, just because of the kind of some of the horror that's involved. But it's kind of like sci-fi, scary, but man, it's really well done. I can't even give it enough kudos. It's really kind of opened my eyes how they just do an amazing job at dealing with the segregated places in this country. There's little innuendos of race, horror. It's so good. If you have HBO, you have to check it out. Like, you don't miss it. Don't be late. You have to check it out. It's really good. You know, I think it opened in, I think it premiered in on the 16th of August. So, I mean, I think we're barely like a month in, so it's not too far to get caught up.
Did you guys watch Watchmen on HBO?
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah, that was good. Yeah.
Just won the Emmys too.
Yeah, that, I just saw it and it was trending, and I didn't know the Emmys were on, but that was a hard show to watch sometimes, but it was a real, real good show.
Yeah.
And especially like you mentioned in the pre-show, Chris, about, you know, having this, framing this conversation, Lovecraft Country, having a black cast, having racial conversations. When H.P. Lovecraft was a notorious racist, I mean, he created some great stories, you know, the Mountains of Madness and all that. But in terms of personal life, seemed like a terrible, terrible person. To kind of have these conversations on top of that name is a powerful statement to make in 2020. So I feel like the creators very conscious of that are doing a good thing, kind of having that conversation. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's amazing how he has been so persistent in, you know, popular culture, as far as like, there's always video games coming out at like HP Lovecraft, there's like books, and it's amazing that somebody like that and some of his views has been so stable in as far as our attention.
Yeah.
Cthulhu. That's what it is. Cthulhu is like one of the all time great sci-fi monsters of the early era that just persists to this day. Yeah. So, yeah.
And you know, it's really kind of gripping that stuff that I've been kind of processing through watching the show, is that despite all the horror and just what you witness in terms of like the monster effects and that kind of thing, but at the end of it, when you strip all that away, it's the racism that is truly like at the root of it. And that's really scary in some ways, you know, even, you know, because that's people's lived experiences. So it's like, I can't, I know a lot of circles that I'm in, you know, with other Black people, and everyone's ranting and raving about it there. So it's definitely worth checking it out. Don't miss it.
Thanks, man. Definitely check that out.
Excellent pick. All right. So that wraps up this episode of Akita Voices. Thanks again to Chris for coming on the show. Is there any before we go, Chris, anything else you want to plug? Anything you want to mention about Career Center, how you're functioning in these COVID times? Anything, you know?
No, I think we're trying to be very proactive about reaching out to students directly, you know, email the whole campus, and, you know, so we're doing our work, and I just want students to, I want to try to find the students who need us and get them into our services. And so if anybody's listening to this, and just tell them we're still working, and we're sending out weekly, you know, information about what we're doing. And it's amazing how all of us have adjusted to this, and with almost without missing a beat. So I just think if you in the past, if you thought you'd come to the Career Center for something, you can come here now. And I don't know where you're coming, but I guess to Starfish and to our Zoom calls. And, you know, I've also been very inspired by online education and trying to set up a lot of things that students can do asynchronously working in the Career Center. So it just doesn't have to be a one-on-one conversation, because with our small staff, we can't do that. So I've been really trying to be inspired by asynchronous online education for a certain segment of the students, you know? So that's all I just want to plead, is just, you know, come find us, and you know, we can help you out. And then secondly, I just want to thank both of you for inviting me on and doing a podcast like this. Two of my favorite people at work, and it's a really, really cool thing. I just want to give you a lot of kudos for doing it. I really appreciate even listening to the ones I, you know, haven't been on, and I really appreciate being on and having the opportunity to talk to you. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. I'm great for you. I knew it was going to be a great show. I'm super jazzed to have you here, and look forward to maybe coming back to you at some later point in time again. Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's just a good, I mean, our whole goal here was to just kind of give a platform for the voices on campus, let people know what's going on around campus and all the people that make up the campus culture that is SBCC, and you're a great representation on that. Like, as we started the show off, it was an honor to have you on. and hopefully we'll do it again sometime.
Well, it was an honor to be on. Thank you.
All right. So until next time, we'll see everyone around, and have a great day.
Thanks for listening.
All right. Bye.